netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
This podcast is proudly brought to you by the new Nuke 8 from the Foundry. Nuke 8 includes countless exciting features and updates. In Nuke 8, artists will notice huge enhancements to the dope sheet. The user experience has been greatly improved with the addition of lots of artist-friendly color controls and in-context help. And it's packed with updates that'll make Nuke even better for users across multiple industries. Check it out at the company website, thefoundry.co.uk.
Thanks for taking the time to download this podcast. I'm John Montgomery. Well, it's the end of the year here at FX Guide, and we've got a great variety of podcasts out. This podcast is covering the recently released second film in the Hobbit trilogy, and we've got four guests in this podcast. We also have a couple great ones up on the site. First of all, we've got our RC Christmas present from Mike and Jason. It's a conversation with Rob Legato on The Wolf of Wall Street, and Rob's always a great interview, and I think you'll enjoy this one very much. For those of you who are FX Insider members, an end-of-year bonus, we have a conversation with the editor of Catching Fire, Alan Bell, and that's available not in the podcast feed, but as an article on the site. You can see that on the homepage. So if you're at home with the family over the holidays, your sister's driving you crazy, not talking about you, Anne, of course, maybe you've got a crazy political discussion with the in-laws, chill out, go to the other room, download a podcast, and relax a little bit for the holiday. And before we get to today's podcast, I just want to mention that through Christmas, we have some outstanding deal on gift certificates over at our sister site, fxphd.com. We have a full-term gift certificate available for only $299. That's a significant savings off the full membership. And our individual course membership add-on courses are also 10% off at $90 a piece. So check out fxphd.com. Those will be available through Christmas Day. Now, getting to our podcast this week, Mike is going to be speaking with four individuals involved with the film. He's going to speak with Eric Sannon, VFX supervisor, Eric Reynolds, who served as animation supervisor, as well as Dave Clayton, another animation supervisor on the film. But we start out with Mike's conversation speaking with Joe Letteri, who's the overall visual effects supervisor at Wet Digital. Let's go ahead and cross to that now.
Truly, the tales and songs fall utterly short of your enormity, O Smaug the Stupendous.
Dragonfire and ruin.
That is what you will bring upon us. He cannot see beyond his own desire.
Of course, from a visual effects point of view, the hero of the Desolation of Smaug is, of course, Smaug himself, the dragon character as produced by Weta Digital. And leading the team at Weta Digital is Joe Letteri, who I have on the line now from New Zealand. Welcome, Joe.
Thank you, Mike.
So congratulations on the digital character of Smaug. But I've got to say, it's not as if you guys haven't done digital characters before, but this has to be one of the most brilliantly executed digital characters I've ever seen.
Well, thank you. I mean, he's a big character, you know, physically large. And a lot of the characters that we've done in the past have been, you know, human or human-type characters. And so with Smaug, what we really worked on was trying to translate the emotion of his performance, you know, especially starting with Benedict Cumberbatch's performance and that great, voice acting that he did, and to try to make that have a physical presence in this large dragon, you know. Not only just a large screen presence, but also the intimate dialogue moments with Bilbo, because those are just as important as the, you know, the moments where he's kind of, you know, big and scary and overwhelming.
I think that's the thing that's most remarkable about this character, is that it's not unprecedented for people to do big, scary characters and big, scary characters that are stupid and lumber around and kill and smash and blow up things. Here you've got a character that really is quite intellectually sort of subtle in their performance at the same time as being large, scary, and bouncing around and crashing into things. It's quite a performance piece.
Mm-hmm. We took our cues from, you know, Tolkien. I mean, he wrote the character as a dialogue scene with Bilbo. And for us, this was very similar to Bilbo's scene with Gollum in Hobbit 1, the Riddles in the Dark scene. Because, you know, if you listen to the way they kind of relate to each other, you can go back to how Tolkien wrote it. There's sort of a courtesy in their encounter. You know, Smaug wakes up from this 200 years of sleep. He knows there's this little, you know, half-human person in there trying to rob him. But yet, you know, he asks who he is. He tries to find out who he is. And he's flattered when Bilbo knows who he is. And so you have this dialogue where Bilbo is really trying to do exactly what Smaug says. Smaug says, "Do you think flattery will save you?" And Bilbo says, "No, but of course that's exactly what saves him." And that's, you know, the subtext that plays throughout. He plays on Smaug's vanity. And you're right, Smaug has this sort of, you know, intellect where he can engage in that. That's as important to him as just, you know, snacking on the little guy.
I also thought the lensing was really a challenge. I mean, apart from the fact that you've got these huge differences in scale, we had mm-hmm. to believe that in shots where Smaug was his own, he was only in shot, had no reference with Bilbo, that he was really big. And of course, that's a hard thing to do because, you know, it's a character we have no relationship to. It's not like there's much else to give us scale. Mm-hmm. I thought the lensing was really nice, but it must have been pretty hard blocking all that out to make it work.
Yeah, it was. We started with the relationships with Bilbo so that we can establish the scale, you know, size between the two. We tried to find camera angles that would, you know, show the two together in proportional size so that at least in your mind you understood what that relationship was. And then we tried to put just detail into Smaug that would give you a sense of his scale. Of course, dragons have scales, so we have to have scales, though, that worked at multiple levels. So then when you're up close, you really got the fine skin, so you could see all the scales wrinkling and so forth as he moved. But when you're farther away, there were larger scales that always gave you a sense of how big he was. And so we would constantly just go from close up to far shot, and we did a lot of camera tests just back and forth to establish all these visual cues that would allow you to always understand how big he is and where he is in space. And so once we started playing the scene, then we could concentrate on just the camera work as you would normally block a scene.
Yeah, well, I thought that was tremendous. It was just a tour de force of character animation, the facial animation, and getting lip sync without it looking comical. It was just it was really well done. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I mean, we you know took a lot of cues from what Benedict had done in his vocal performance, and just really tried to make sure that intent, that nuance, translated to it. And, you know, as you say, this is a head that's not a human head. It basically is a monster head. So where do you put the dialogue? How do you project the dialogue? And we just tried to keep everything really forward so that it was always intimate to him and Bilbo. And that way it felt much more like a dialogue scene than you might have gotten otherwise.
Joe Letteri, the four-time Oscar winner, is the senior visual effects supervisor at Weta, and of course all films effectively go through him. The specific visual effects supervisor for the film The Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug is Eric Sandon. Eric is joining me on the line now. Now, Eric is in serious need of a holiday because he's been working extremely hard, but he, in addition to doing all the on-set supervision work, focused very much on Smaug. So if I could ask you this, Eric, I guess you're desperately in need of a holiday, but thanks for talking to us.
I leave for holiday on Monday, finally. So after a very long but fun year, I head off on a holiday on Monday with my fourth kid who was born at the very end of production, which made it even more interesting.
Wow. Well, congratulations on that. Boy or a girl?
Thank you. A boy.
Congratulations.
So two of each now.
So I wanted to talk to you about Smaug, who apparently, according to Forbes magazine, is the wealthiest fictional character with a current valuation of $62 billion of wealth in today's standards.
Yeah, they were way off. we actually did a bit of a calculation here. One of the more brilliant guys here actually did a volume for Erebor to figure out the gold volume based on two or three of the big wide shots, and figured out that the current New Zealand value of the gold was somewhere around $40 quadrillion. It was a ridiculous amount of gold.
But there was a point to this anecdote, which was I also understood from somewhere I read, or I think one of the production blogs, that there was about 200 billion pieces of treasure, as in placing the character in their environment is always difficult. But I was going to ask you right out of the gate just how much more difficult it was placing this character in this particular environment of their massive piles of coins.
Well, since the coins were pretty much all digital, we did have a on-set sort of ramp with a whole pile of art department coins. Unfortunately, once you got that into the film and really started having the Martin interacting with those coins and trying to really move down through them, they were polystyrene, painted gold, so they really didn't look like gold once we got them on film. So we didn't really use a lot of that, and we ended up replacing most of it with CG gold. We ended up writing our own rigid body solver to be able to interact this much gold with the dragon. So because the dragon is essentially two 747s in width and length, the scale at which the number of coins we had to dump on top of the dragon to really bury him within the gold was enormous. And we wanted to be able to solve all this gold at once. So we wrote our own solver that allowed us to do, I think the biggest shot we did was close to 20 million coins, all interacting, all rigid body solved, able to solve them essentially overnight on some pretty hefty render wall machines.
For the complexity of that size, you also have incredible close-up shots to deal with. I was just wondering how much the software needed to completely work with different models of the dragon to deal with that, or was there just a lot of intelligence and a lot of scope to be able to go in and out from one scale to another?
A lot of it was just intelligence in the way we built it. We only had one model for the dragon. There's some very, very close shots right on the lips of the dragon, and that's the same dragon we use when we pull really far back, so he's just a dot and screen flying off into Lake Town. So it's always the same dragon, always the same model. But we use intelligence to say don't render as much detail with the high resolution displacements, sort of a level of detail procedure as we pull away from the dragon. But we always find that once you start to have several different models, they always tend to sway a little bit, and one differs from another one. You can always tell the difference. So we prefer to try to keep one and make it work for everything.
While we're discussing that, can you just give us a rundown on that pipeline? I presume you were using Mari for the texturing. I was wondering what the sort of references were for the texturing, because there seems to be very much sort of like snake-type references that I saw, but a lot of other more scale, rigid sort of, hard to describe it really. It's almost like a scale over the top of skin type approach.
Yeah, we did a lot of different references, a lot of reptiles. Unfortunately, there's absolutely no reptiles except tuataras in New Zealand. So we had to go to Australia to shoot a lot of photos of in the Australia Zoo. I went and photographed all kinds of snakes and iguanas and different types of reptiles just as
reference.
Sorry,
there are no reptiles in New Zealand?
No, not really. There's tuataras.
Okay.
And that's pretty much about it. There's no snakes. There's no...
We have quite a lot of those, so...
You have a few over in Australia.
Glad to help out.
Yeah, but we have nothing. There's nothing dangerous here whatsoever. So bad drivers is about all we have here. So a lot of different types of reptiles and some fish and some... we use a lot of crocodiles, caimans, things like that as different areas. So the back of Smog is big, solid sort of scales, a lot The scales themselves sort of like a tortoise skin or a tortoise shell, but built into a scale. So very hard, very solid. Each individual scale, we tried to actually build as many of the scales as we could. So anything over a certain size, we actually built as interactive scales that were solved on his back. On going down his side were all solved scales, so they all interacted with one another, crashed against each other. When he bent his back, they all folded up on one another so that we got proper motion without having scales being bent. His belly was more smaller scales, sort of like a snake skin, where the scales, you don't particularly see them overlapping one another, but you sort of see the hard shell of his stomach. So when he moves, we tried to limit the motion of the bending of the of his skin to between the scales, so you got proper flexing, and when the light hits it, you can actually see the pattern of the scales through. So trying to be as accurate as we could, and still be able to get the animation through to a render in a reasonable amount of time.
If you have a hide on an animal, then you can allow a certain amount of stretching in the way that a sort of a human skin would, and the paws are going to obviously have a kind of a stretch to them, but generally you can bend them. But there's a rigidity to these scales that must have made it much more complex in terms of sort of solving that from a sim point of view.
It was. It meant we had to do a lot of this same thing. We tried to limit any kind of flexing, any kind of movement to between the scales, or allowing the scales to push over the top of one another properly, sort of like a shingle roof, to get the bend without making the scales bend.
And then how did you deal with the face? Because the face seems to have a rigidity to it, but doesn't have that kind of overlapping scale look of, say, the neck or the back of the neck.
It does, but for the face, we did use a lot of crocodile reference, because they're very stiff, bony, but still flesh-like skin. So it goes a lot into the character of Smaug too. We wanted to have character to Smaug, but we couldn't particularly have soft lips that were able to animate. So getting something like Benedict's performance onto Smaug was a challenge, because we wanted to have the motion on there so we get the performance of Benedict, but without the really loose lips and making him look soft. Like he had to, Peter's drive was to really make him a hard, psychotic character throughout the movie. And if we had soft lips on him that really moved around a lot, it just, you sort of lose that very quickly.
Yeah, I was wondering if we could switch gears to talk about that performance capture, because obviously, you know, performance capture is something you guys have done very, very well over the years, but I would have thought this is the mother of all retargeting, because apart from anything else, there's the wrong number of limbs, the kind of wrong physical distribution. I mean, how do you actually get any meaningful translation of the data, or is it that the performance capture is much more kind of a reference performance capture?
It's more reference performance capture in this case. It wasn't particularly a performance capture in this one. We did get a camera on Benedict when he was on the ADR stage, so we were able to get his performance, as in his head gestures, because a lot of the animation of Smaug comes from more of his gestures than his actual facial movement, because he just doesn't have a lot of facial movement. So a lot of his head motions and a lot of Benedict's head motions go into how to get the look of Smaug. His glowing stomach, his eyes get brighter and glow more when he's angry. We did try to get some of Benedict's facial performance, like around his eyes. There's no real translation for nose movements per se, or even mouth. I mean, there's not much you can get there. And as far as body goes, it doesn't really translate. Unfortunately, it's probably the least amount of translation we could get on from character to character in this case.
Yeah, because there are apocryphal stories of actually him lying down on benches and doing stuff, and it just seemed to me a really odd sort of that there would be so many physical or physics aspects of that translation that would make the sort of attempt to use that anything other than sort of a visual reference pretty hard.
Yeah, I mean, that's all it was, really. I mean, I've seen a few articles that have really talked about performance capture on Benedict in this case, but unfortunately we used him more for reference and not it's definitely not a straight performance capture, as in how Andy becomes Gollum. It's not quite as straightforward as that, unfortunately.
Which brings me to the question of the actual performance of the, say, for the head movements, for example, and a good example that you gave, you know, it's a reference, but obviously it's a completely different neck. Was this done by a team of animators where you divided up based on having scenes? I mean, how did you kind of get a continuity? Because there's a lot of actual animation to be done and a lot of performance to be put in, but you obviously want that performance to be consistent throughout the character's portrayal.
Yeah, definitely. Well, a lot of the animation was done in big, broad scoping passes to get everything, like the dialogue between Smaug and Bilbo was done in one big, long take, so that we got a performance, and then Pete could get in there with cameras and sort of. He did sort of the same thing for the forges. We broke it up into four different bits. Animators would take one section, animate out the broad scope of the motion. Pete took that animation, brought it onto the mocap stage, and then put cameras on that motion where he wanted to catch the performance he liked the best. And then we broke that into different shots with editorial. And animators then had the idea of the motion and knew where to start. So we could break it off into several different animators to go through.
So much in the same way that actors on a space would sort of block and work the space before the DOP would film it, you've actually got that performance.
Exactly. And that's pretty much exactly what we did. I mean, we wanted to have a rehearsal, per se, of the whole thing. And then get in and figure out the cameras. So the same we'd do on a set, you'd have the actors run through the set, do the performance they feel works for the set, and then Pete would get in and decide, okay, well, the best angle for that is here, so this is what we want to do. And it's essentially what he did on the mocap stage. And it gave him a lot more freedom, and it gave him a lot... It really brings the third act together, because Pete really... He was able to show off what he wanted for storytelling purposes. Like in a certain case, he might want to show the claw smashing through the gate in the forges sequence. The best way to do that is to really get the camera in there so that when the claw smashes through the gate and comes onto the floor, you get exactly the hit you want. And when he was in there with the camera, it's much easier for him just to get the thing he wants rather than try to describe it to an animator and then have that translated back in the animator's head back to the screen. And it never comes across quite the way he wants it. And he really loved doing the film this way.
So in terms of the animators being able to work with the rigged face of the dragon, I mean, there's a lot of bounce light coming up, not least of which because of all these coins we started with. So, and that can really dramatically affect an expression, just how a character like this is lit, whether or not you can see their eyes or whether they're shadowed, that kind of thing. But you got all that at the desktop level when you're animating, I guess.
Yeah, it is tricky that way too, because the shape of Smaug's face really didn't like to light in. So you really had to be very careful. And when lighting Smaug, you always had to get the eye light in first before any other light was done. Make sure you have an eye light in there properly, and then get in and do the rest of the lighting. And because we use indirect for everything, we got lots of nice gold bounce off the gold itself with so much gold in the room. We didn't want to play any source lights, so all the light is sort of hidden within Erebor. You never see any source lights, at least in the treasure hall area. And we're playing a lot of indirect bounce off the dragon, which tends to play very moody monster lighting on the dragon. So you get very monster lit. Pete really wanted to go for a film noir look on this one. So the dragon goes in and out of very dark, very bright areas, sort of the film noir look. So that's what we were going for.
Yeah, because it's interesting, isn't it? The nature of most monsters that would look this evil on paper, to use that expression, they're almost never intelligent. You know, they're like thuggy kind of gits that just run around smashing over things and gnashing teeth. Here you've got all of that from a physical point of view on paper, but you have to convey real intelligence and arrogance and kind of a whole bunch of other stuff on top. I guess the eyes were key to that?
The eyes and the head movement, really. To me, that's the one thing that really sold it to me, is the eyes, the position at which the head was when he was looking at Bilbo. If he's looking down his nose, he's sort of inquisitive. If he's lowered his nose and looking through his eyelids a little bit more, you tend to read him as a bit more angry. So it's a lot of, to me, a lot of what we got from the animation for the mood, the character of Smaug was a lot from his head position. It was interesting to see as shots started to come through. So you really started to respond to how he was looking at you and the direction at which he was you were seeing the dragon.
Were the eyes always looking like they are? Because they're quite complicated. I mean, they really are like a sort of an original eye in that sense.
Yeah, they were not. They went through a lot of different iterations. So we always try to build a very complex eye model, as realistic as we can, with the limitations of you can only have so much geometry in the eye. But we try to put lots and lots and lots of layers of the eye, so that you get a volume to the eye. And if you really, not that you ever see it in the shots, but if you get a good, let's say a turntable of the eye, you can actually see lots and lots of layers of the eye itself, and you read it as a volume, not just a plane with a texture on it.
So, in fact, its lensing is dramatically affecting my perception of where it's looking in a close-up, isn't it?
Yes, for sure, because it's about a half a meter from the outer edge of the eye to the actual lens itself, or to the pupil itself. So it's a very big distance. So as you're seeing the refraction through the lens itself, it really does change your perception of where he's looking.
And so moving away from the face, so it's a classic thing with a dragon, we all want to see them breathe fire. There's certainly fire in this. Was there anything that you tried to do a little differently in terms of how the dragon would either generate, breathe fire, or react to the fire in terms of, I mean, I guess there's a huge amount of contact lighting, but anything else?
Well, we did a couple things, really. Because early tests we did, we tried to emit fire directly from the dragon's mouth. Like you would think that would be the best way to do it. But because our fire simulation is very, we've tried to come up with a very realistic fire simulation, by the time it got 20, 30 meters out, the fire pretty much just became a big ball, and it had no detail to it. It really didn't have a very good look. It was very soft. It was no detail. It looked like a crappy CG fire. So what we did was we actually use a fluid system to emit fluid from the dragon, sort of like a fire hose, directly from his mouth. And then we do a solve for that fluid being emitted and splatting on the wall or splatting on whatever. And then we actually ignite that fluid. So we don't have the fire come directly from the dragon. We have it come from the fluid that came out of his mouth. So the fire hose is essentially lit on fire. And that way we have super high resolution detail in the fire because it's being generated all the way out, the hose per se. And you come up with a really great look for the fire with lots of detail and lots of interaction. And we really see it hit the wall and ignite the wall on fire. It just really adds to the look of the fire.
And how did you handle the weight distribution issues, given that the creature just is, you know, quite oddly unique in its wings and legs kind of thing? Is there anything that you pulled in from, I don't know, like bats or anything else that have very large wings that also have kind of an ability to use them for for moving, just in terms of, there's obviously a bunch of close-up shots where his movement is not his whole body, but away from the actual flying when he's moving around?
A lot of the animation we did for this for Smog, we found that one of the best ways to do it is actually to get the dragon animated for a shot and then slow the whole thing down. We really found that we would get the animators to run their scene, get them animated the way they felt was right, and then more often than not, if you slow it down 25% from that, you tend to come up with something that feels much bigger and has more weight. So a lot of times we ended up just doing that. We slowed him down. We did use lots of reference where we could, bats, things like that, but they really don't move the same way. It's even with the wings, flapping of the wings, we can use things like that. We tried to use eagle reference or condor reference because they're very big. There's a scene where the dragon takes off, runs and takes off, and we actually use I forgot the bird's name. The really big bird.
Like a condor or a...
No, it's really dopey bird. I've forgotten the name. Oh my god, albatross.
Okay.
Couldn't remember. We used a lot of the when albatross take off, they do this run thing, and they look terrible when they're taking off, but when they're flying, they look amazing. And we did the same sort of idea for the dragon. He doesn't look right when he's running along the ground, but once he gets going, he's very elegant flying through the air.
So if I could just switch to the rendering for a second, is this the same basic, it's obviously, I shouldn't use the word basic, the same fundamental pipeline that you've used recently with the pan array and the sort of move towards physically plausible shading and lighting? How are you lighting?
Yeah, we're always trying to move further towards the physically correct lighting. So in a lot of this movie, we've moved to strictly ray tracing. So we're, for all of Erebor, because of all the coins and the scale of everything, we found that going to things like shadow maps didn't work for us because there was always trace bias errors, things like that. So we went to a strictly ray traced solution with indirect and subsurface and everything being run through ray trace.
And so it's fundamentally a variation or rather a building out from the RenderMan sort of pipeline. In other words,
yep.
You've sort of expanded on that as you have been in the past, because there is an enormous amount of geometry to deal with in these scenes with the treasure. And I was just wondering how much that was holding up or how much you had to sort of separate anything out, because there's some weird stuff floating around the net that it took a week to render a scale on Smog's body. I'm not quite sure how that you'd ever bother to render a single scale, but I imagine the render times were pretty bad.
They were good, but I mean they weren't. It wasn't a week to render scale. it was. I think on average it was probably a day or two to render a shot. So a typical shot probably took a dragon shot. Maybe took. I'd say an order of 20 hours per frame for the dragon and environment.
And the fact that we've got a lot of flames and smoke and atmosphere, was this a deep composite pipeline as you pioneered earlier?
Yep, we do everything with deep compositing. So we don't do mats, we don't do anything like that. We do everything with deep compositing, which is brilliant. It's changed the way we do things, really. So... I think I can't even imagine doing things without deep compositing at this point, because it allows us to do other things too. Like in the forges, we're able to bring in we can essentially bring in a light in the compositing and cast shadows into the deep data. So we can do a volume for the forges area and cast shadows within the volume, so we can get interactive shadows in the volume of atmosphere at the compositing stage, which gives you a lot more flexibility to move things around and really come up with a really interesting looks and really graphic looks, which was great.
Yeah, I've got to say, I became aware of that when you published, I think, at SIDGRAPH or thereabouts, the stuff to do with Abraham Lincoln Vampire Slayer, the horses scene in that. And I was interested to see how much you move beyond just using it to determine or relieve the need for holdout mats, and how much you'd moved to incorporate it as part of a creative pipe that would allow for lighting and shadows in those volumetric transmissive media, which is just spectacular.
Yeah, now we've come up with better solutions for that. So the same idea we did for Lincoln Vampire Slayer, that was very slow and a bit awkward at the time, we're able to do sort of, I wouldn't say real time, but a very fast solution within Nuke, using a very similar tools, but just reworked in a different way.
Yeah, I think it was working in collaboration with Nuke's PMAP stuff, so that you could really do some interesting stuff in the comp in terms of like height fields off ground planes and stuff. And it certainly gave a lot of flexibility to the compositors, it seemed. But how much do you want to be playing with that in the comp, and how much do you want to have it nailed in the animation? And then, because you have creative flexibility, but I guess you don't want to necessarily...
We create flexibility, but we don't render things in different passes. We don't do, I know a lot of houses do key light and then ambient light and things like that in their beauty lighting, and then they do the lighting in comp essentially. And we don't really do that. We like to do the lighting properly. On the Dragon, for example, we wouldn't light in lots of layers and then put it together in the comp, because it never really comes out the same. When you're talking subsurface and things like that, you sort of have to get all the lights together at the proper levels to get the proper subsurface. If you try to do it on the comp, you don't get any of that. You don't get the proper indirect bounce from one area to the other. You don't get the proper subsurface through his wings or through the horns on his back. We just find that it doesn't work right for us. So we like to do it all in lighting. And then we do leave flexibility in the comp for things like adding lens information, lens distortions, and lens dirt, and there's so many other things we need to do in the comp anyways, getting the fire and getting all the other elements in to really bring it from the CG environment and CG character to reality.
Comparing to Bog or Azog or characters that are like humanoid, was there any sort of, other than the obvious, was there any sort of challenges or unexpected things about a dragon? Because you have these other terrific fully digital characters that are much more, you know, biped kind of humanoid type creatures.
A lot of it, for me, a lot of it was just the enormous scale, trying to sell the scale of the dragon. You find things like if the f-stop was set slightly higher than you would have expected, then it was really hard to get the eye of the dragon in focus and keep the rest of them in focus sometimes, because he's just so big that a lot of times it's hard to sell his scale and really show him without having a scale reference in the shot. So once you had like Bilbo in the shot, it was easy. He's like, Bilbo's the size of his eyeball, so it's pretty straightforward. It's easy to tell how big the dragon is. But once you get him in this enormous Erebor treasure hall, let's say, there's really no scale reference to show how big he is. So it's that was one of the big challenges I found, that it was trying to keep the fact of how big he is and still make him mysterious and move properly through the spaces. So
I've got to let you go, but I just want one last question. Was it funny seeing him on the side of a Air New Zealand jet?
Actually, I did that one. So it was, in fact, they just sent me one of those little scale models today, which is very interesting. So we flew over. That's how we got to the premiere. Me and Kevin, the producer, flew over on that jet. It was pretty fun to. That was the biggest render I've ever done. It was a 66K render, which was the largest render I've ever done. It was pretty fun to see on the side of the plane. Unfortunately, it doesn't really do it any justice on the side of a plane. But
it's a lot smaller than it should be, isn't it?
Yeah.
I would have loved to have been the...
It's still only half the size it should be, unfortunately.
I'd love to have been the print guy getting that file delivered on a hard drive. I can't imagine they get that many...
It was about a half a terabyte, so it was a very large file. It took a long time to save, and unfortunately, it was pretty much it was at the point where we had 3 weeks left to finish the film that I was trying to do that one along with supervising the movie.
Joining Eric and Key to the team was two animation supervisors, Eric Reynolds and Dave Clayton. I spoke to Dave first about the facial puppet, the rigging of Smaug's face, because I was curious, with a character this complicated, what were the animators actually seeing? Because there's a lot of subtlety in the performance of the character, but then by the same token, this has got to be one of the weightiest and heaviest actual models. So what did the animator actually have, and how easy was it for them to actually see at their actual workstation what it was going to look like?
Yeah, that's a good point. And we did put a lot of energy into Smaug's facial puppet, and making sure the animators had a very high resolution version of that face in their animation scenes. The models team, Mark Hanger and Gustav Aron, they did a great facial puppet for us that had like different levels of resolution, so you could do low resolution, high resolution, and the high resolution is basically the same model that you see rendered in shots. And it's still, fairly scrubbable in our scenes. And, that was invaluable to just get those little subtle nuances into his face.
What about the eyes for eye lines? Because, again, you've got this massive creature and he's sort of focused in on this tiny dot of a hobbit from a staging point of view. But I imagine if you didn't have accurate rendering of the eyes, it'd be really hard to get that eye line right.
No, we had a fairly accurate, 100% accurate model of the eye, and then of course under different lighting circumstances that can sort of change the perception of where the eye is looking. So it's a lot of trial and error, and just the shape of his face as well. He's got a sort of a crocodilian dinosaur sort of head and sort of sideways facing eyes, so depending on the angle of his head he had to sort of adjust his eye line, maybe skew his eyes outwards or something to get him to look about right. But it's just sort of a shot-by-shot basis thing.
In the scenes where it's just Bilbo talking to Smaug and they're delicately walking around large quantities of gold, it seems to me that I can imagine you being able to, though it's technically impressive that you could scrub that, once they get to the foundry where there's so much other sort of stuff going on.
So, we have a lot of tricks. Like, we turn off his wings. We don't even deal with the membranes of the wings until we're, getting right near the final animation stage, because they just slow everything down. But there's been a lot of technology improvements at Weta. As far as, facial animation, it used to be horribly slow. You'd have to just, pose the face, and then go forward 10 frames, and it would finally catch up, and you'd do another pose. And now you can actually scrub it. It's just so much better than it was even a few years ago. So Smaug, benefited from all of that. But he was a fairly slow puppet, even with all the tricks that we did. And we have a bunch of pretty smart animators, and they all had, I think every animator had his own tool set of how he solved that. There's one animator that would just strip the whole puppet down to cubes and animate with that until he got all his basic timings and performances correct, and then he would bring it in the actual little Smaug puppet and copy those curves over.
Did you have to sort of break that apart to get sort of the dragon performance, the face performance, and then put it all together with all the other props and stuff? Because it's a very, very complicated set.
Yeah, there's so many different effects passes and everything. But as animators, we had our dragon, we had our sort of main prop elements and pieces of destruction or placeholders for liquid gold. The effects team did a great job of supplying that sort of stuff to us in low resolution formats. Like, to use the example of the gold room where he's first encounters Bilbo and he's sort of slithering through gold and interacting, and the guys came up with a plugin for us called WM Pile that allowed us to sort of make the gold surface a live deformer in our scenes, and it would preserve its volume. So if Smaug pushed through it, it would displace gold from one position to another, and it allowed us as animators to kind of be aware of the compositional
aspect of the goal, you know, where it was going to end up in frame, and also just be mindful of our animation on Smaug to not move him too quickly, or to not sort of pop his foot, you know, around when it was under the goal, and that would in turn cause problems with the simulation later. So we really tried to you know, work together with the effects team early on to iron out any potential issues, you know, before we hit sort of full-scale production.
You mentioned not moving him too quickly. One of the great advantages you had in the coin gold scene earlier is that you could have a bit of screen time to have this enormous character kind of move with the speed that an enormous character would dictate. But once you get into some of the latter sequences, it seemed to me that the necessity of editing, the necessity of story, meant that things had to move a bit quicker. Was it difficult to keep the sense of scale of this enormous creature? And of course, you know, it's not even like these the hobbits and stuff are even human height. They're meant to be even smaller than that.
Yeah, I guess you just—it's one of the major challenges as an animator is to make sure your creature has scale. And you know, he doesn't have any sort of cloth or clothing or anything hanging off him, which is one thing that gives, you know, CG characters a sense of scale and mass. So we had to—it's pretty much keyframe everything. So I think, you know, the use of his tail was a good example of how we could, you know, just use that tail as a counterpoint to his body and head motion to sort of, you know, if his body and head would arrive in a pose, his tail could be still arriving in the next shot. You know, it could really sort of offset all his motions, and like his tail is basically twice the length of his entire body is made up of his tail, so it's heavy and it's big, and it allowed us to add scale to his motion.
Yeah, though it's a face that doesn't lend itself to a lot of articulated lip sync. I mean, you nailed it, but it's just like it's inherently quite a rigid head, isn't it?
It is, and that was, you know, what we did about a year ago, actually, is we got word that Peter would like to see some lip sync studies of our current design and how it would look, you know, engaging in lip sync speech. And so we put together a little team, and we just we got our hands on some early footage of Benedict performing as Smaug, and we just tried to transpose that over, and we tried some different things, and, you know, how much lip motion should we use versus just jaw, that kind of thing. Should we focus the lip motion on the front of his lips, or should we use the entire length of his kind of crocodilian snout, nostrils as well? And we found that like a nose wrinkler, you know, sort of a sneering sort of shape, actually helped with heaps of the lip sync. Like any time he says, you know, he or something that has like an E or an ah, you just engage that nose wrinkler and bang, it sells that syllable. And you know, I was kind of thinking, man, this is going to be a massive challenge. But we just sort of went through it systematically, and we did loosen up his lips quite a lot. Like we gave him gums. So, you know, like a normal crocodile, the gums and the lips are sort of the same thing, and the teeth are just sort of fused in there. But with Smaug, we gave him separate gums, and the lips kind of, you know, move on top of that, sort of more like a dog or something, you know. But, of course, observing the scales and the rigidity that would be inherent with that many scales. But, yeah, we gave him a full range of lip shapes, funnelers, stretchers, puckerers, you name it. Like anything that we'd have on Gollum or Azog, we put on Smaug. And then we'd split them out along the length of the muzzle, you know, front lip raises, mid lip raises, back lip raises, just to give as much flexibility as we could. And then for the models team, they had to really model those shapes and making sure that they didn't stretch, you know. So we had to buckle scales and kind of wrinkle them up and stuff. If an area of skin was compressing, we could never stretch or squash scales, just because we were going to be up really close to this guy, and he was delivering a full range of dialogue and performance and expression, speaking quite quickly at times. We've got a shot where we've got a 20mm wide lens right next to his muzzle, you know. So we had to put a lot of detail in those areas.
I think the thing that I find really interesting about this, and Lord only knows Weta has done its more than its fair share of creatures over time, and I guess you got some of this in Planet of the Apes, but you've got a creature that in this film is everything that a vicious, gnarly, big, ugly creature should be, But they're incredibly intelligent and articulate and have an almost cultured kind of perception. And this is, I imagine, somewhat of a challenge. I mean, it's pretty, you know, kind of more standard fare, I guess, to have the thug-like kind of raging monster. But you had to get us the terror and the perceptive insight. Was it the eyes? How did you kind of get that idea of this as being an intelligent creature, not just a fierce creature?
Yeah, I think the duality in Smaug is what makes him so exciting as a character, and especially, you know, as animators, we were so excited to work on this character, because, you know, like you say, he's got plenty of range within his personality and stuff, but also just, you know, as a creature, he is a creature. He's a crocodilian, you know, reptile, dragon thing. But he's also a character that needs to act alongside Martin Freeman and you know, all the other characters. So, you know, it's just the ultimate challenge, really, isn't it? To bring to life a creature, but have him sort of stand up against great actors. So yeah, it was pretty cool and pretty exciting. How did we give him that sort of personality? I think there were moments where he had to move around a lot, but then there were also really still moments. And Peter was really specific about that, like just before he's about to pounce on Bilbo, for example, just before Bilbo puts on the ring and escapes, he just recoils back, and Peter was like, just cut out all the motion right here. I want a really still moment, because I think it'll be really threatening if he's just really still. All the tail, everything's just got to stop moving for a beat so we can just, you know, appreciate what's about to happen, and it'll be chilling. And
that shot you're referring to, yeah, it had overtones of like a cobra, didn't it? Sort of
Exactly. Any sort of predatorial animal that's about to strike, it's not going to be moving around very much, is it? It's just going to be poised. And that worked really well, because it came off the, you know, the end of a sequence where he was, you know, quite enraged and sort of destroying columns and whatnot. So yeah, he had to have a full range of motion and acting. And I think the use of another great idea of Peter's was to put extra sort of forefingers and an opposable thumb onto Smaug's wings, in addition to his sort of wing membranes, so that he could have hands. And, you know, I think the hands just, not only did they allow him to negotiate his environment, you know, within Erebor, they allowed him also to sort of act and, you know, get into threatening poses and everything. Hands are really emotive, you know, just like the face. Hands can help you tell a story. And it was really cool to have a dragon that had these hands and wings in the sort of fused together like that. It's awesome.
It felt like you're using the wings like elbows and shoulders, allowing you to get the kind of shoulders up, and that gave it a kind of a lurching forward kind of motion that really, really seemed to work well.
Yeah, exactly. Like if you hadn't had those hands, you wouldn't have been able to slither through Erebor and grab columns and push things over. And he also articulated them and like dragged his fingers through the gold and stuff, and in a sort of a threatening, condescending way as he's talking to Bilbo. Yeah, they afforded a lot of opportunities to do cool stuff.
Well, you've created what is going to become one of the most iconic characters in modern CG, so congratulations on that. It's a spectacular performance.
Thank you very much. Yeah, we're all very proud. The whole team, you know, at least sort of 50 animators putting in a good, solid year of experimentation and hard work. And, yeah, everybody's really happy with the result. And, yeah, pretty excited that we got to work on such a cool creature.
Yeah, and I've got to say, everything seemed to gel. The rendering, the lighting was just magnificent. It really was just a spectacular team effort. You guys have just be totally congratulated.
Yeah, thank you.
So I was wondering if I could talk back earlier, Mirkwood, in terms of the spiders sequence, because this is quite a ambitious and complex task to animate these giant spiders. How quickly did you just sort of come at the relative sizes and approaches to the spiders? Was it always very clear as to how this was going to come together, or was there some sort of R&D to kind of figure out how they would move and how they would relate?
There's always R&D on pretty much everything that we do. We knew we had Shelob from the Lord of the Rings as kind of a a guide to the rough idea of the size that we thought the spiders would be. The spiders in Mirkwood are more web-based, so they weren't going to be quite as much of like a tarantula-type spider, but would be more of like an orb web-spinning spider, something with thinner legs, and so it would move different than Shelob. And so we had to do a bunch of R&D as far as they're large creatures, so they can't move fast, and they have a lot of weight. But all the spiders that we're basing them off of, which are these web-spinning spiders, tend to move fast and very quick, lightning quick. And so we had to kind of find a balance of how fast we could move them. And you'll in the movie, you'll see, I think, like on the attack, they move fairly quickly. And otherwise, we had to slow them down quite a bit just to make sure that we could maintain that kind of weight. And then the other thing we had to do, and we knew it was going to be a big R&D thing, was the webs. Those were going to take a huge amount of time with the effects department and even in animation to get those to work right. Because, you know, every step that they take, every move is going to cause a web to move. And then that web's connected to other webs, and those webs are connected to possibly branches and all of that stuff. That weight from the spider has to trickle through all of those various objects. So we knew it was going to be a bit of time for every shot with spiders in it to get all the animation done.
So Joe told us that it was essentially a cloth sim, the webs, but that struck me as being a particularly difficult problem for an animator because, you know, as opposed to cloth that is being just driven on a character and then would sort of fall and move depending on what the master character is, this is sort of like a bunch of cloth that's going to interact and affect the motion of the spider, but in of itself it isn't on the spider.
Yeah, it was a bit of a horse and cart thing where we would animate the spider, and then they could do like a cloth sim, and based on that, we'd then have to go back and readjust the spider, to tie in with the motion that was in the web. And we also had, in addition to the cloth sim stuff, there was, I think we had three different web puppets. We had kind of a sheet web that we could go in and do controls on to mimic the weight of the spider on it. And we also had a strand, like a single strand web that we could use for some hero bits, some close-up web strands by the camera. And we had something called the sock, which is what it sounds like. It's a sock of web that had a lot of controls, and we actually used that quite a bit. That's kind of the thing that connected all the cocoons of the dwarves onto the trees and had a lot of interaction with the spiders. And all of that stuff was hand-animated.
Yeah, I was wondering about the weight issue because, you know, a spider to me defies gravity. It doesn't sort of have that kind of obvious transference of weight that a monkey or, for example, really look, you can tell which are the weight-bearing limbs. But in a spider, they're small, they just seem to defy gravity. Yet when you get to this size, with the exception of a crowd favourite when the spider got its limbs pulled off and thumped on top of one of the dwarfs. But apart from that, I was just wondering about how you dealt with that gravity and weight issue and just the weight transference, given that they were at very odd angles to the trees and to the environment.
Right. Well, again, we always go look at reference, and we have a bunch of really good, one of the animators had actually a really large garden orb spider right outside his back door and took a bunch of reference of it, wrapping up cicadas and various other insects that got into its web. So we start with that as a basis, and then we'll just do some straight ahead keyframe animation, mimicking some of those motions, and then we'll just go and start flowing it down and trying to find that sweet spot where it feels like the size is right. As far as tricks go, I get what you're saying. They have eight legs, so you can't really show, you know, through the hips.
Yeah, you look at that sort of lumbering that you get with a classic large beast.
Yeah, where the weight's being planted. So we kind of cheated a little bit. We just pretended that the front two legs of the spider were kind of moving in that way. So if he planted the right front leg, we would maybe tilt the body a little bit in that direction to kind of mimic that idea that he's pushing all of his weight on there. If you actually watch a spider move, I mean, they don't use all eight legs all the time anyways. They'll skip a step every once in a while, and on some of them, they even just drag their back legs. They don't really need them. So you do get a lot more work out of those front two legs than the back ones.
And given
as
that
far
they're
as, like, selling the weight.
Yeah, I mean, they have some very sort of nasty-looking teeth-type action at the front, but generally speaking, we don't sort of have an obviously posable head in the way that you do with a wolf or a, for that matter, a dragon. So I was just wondering, in terms of getting posture to give you character? Was there a lot of work to try and sort of give attitude from a shape that doesn't really lend itself to the kind of obvious character motivation that we'd get from a biped?
Yeah, again, that's a good thing to bring up. I mean, the spiders all have these exoskeletons. They're hard. They're unmoving. They can't move their head. It's bolted onto their thorax, and that really limits your acting. And it also makes it very hard to sell weight. So in animation, we always do this, and we anger the creature department because they always go, "You can't bend that stuff. That's hard. That's solid shell." But if we can't bend the head at all, you know, twist the thorax a little bit. It, like I said, it's very hard to sell weight. I mean, big, heavy animals have bodies that can contort and move and, you know, and adjust as the weight goes from one leg to the other. So we kind of had to find a happy medium. And our heads on our spiders do move around, and the thorax twists a bit. And we did overdo it in a few shots, and we'd have to go back and downplay it a little bit. But I think that was all just part of the R&D of figuring out what we could get away with to sell the weight, but to still make it feel like it was an insect body and wasn't made of rubber.
Can I jump to the other end of the spectrum? So the team also had to work on, say, the barrel sequence. Now, the trick here, of course, is to make me believe that I'm not looking at some fantastical creature, apart from, of course, the orcs that are chasing them. But apart from those orcs, the guys in the barrels and everything else at times must have had to resulted in computer graphics, because we know that you wouldn't have risked the actors' lives. But here, of course, you want to be the other end of the spectrum, completely believable, completely realistic, completely sort of humanoid in a sense.
Yeah. No, the barrel sequence was always going to be an exciting kind of dynamic sequence, and the sort of the three types of shots that we used to bring it all together were all CG shots, of course, for the more sort of crazy, outlandish type ones, and then we had live action plates that were shot on location in Aotearoa Rapids, and the guys sent real barrels down those watercourses without anybody in them, and then we tracked them and put CG dwarves inside, and you know.
For those people that don't know, this is a river in what, the north of the South Island, where there's a dam that was releasing water, causing these kind of rapids. I think what, three times a day or something.
Yeah, exactly. So it allowed the guys up there to get the barrels ready, and then you know, when they released the dam, they could have all the cameras set up and get some amazing shots of this white water with barrels in, and you know, it made it really organic and realistic, obviously, and it allowed us to then match our CG shots, you know, to that sort of level of turbulence in the water and the aeration and everything. And also from an animation perspective, PJ asked us to rotomate some of those barrels because they had such beautiful organic motion, and he wanted them to really gel, you know, with the CG shots. So we sort of went through reels of footage and picked out cool little barrel motions and little organic bits of them going over waterfalls and stuff that we could use in the CG shots, and it helped boost that realism.
But I understand that there was also at least 35 hours of green screen dry set footage, right, which just had to be incorporated.
Yeah, exactly, and that was for actors' close-ups and stuff, and most of those were just, you know, background extensions, maybe adding in extra CG dwarves and barrels, orcs and elves and such. So they really sort of glued it all together and, you know, gave us our close-ups of the actors.
Was it difficult matching that in, because there's a variety of cameras that we use to film that footage? There's also obviously no sort of static set that you can go and stick an HDR in to get a good lighting reference. I mean, at some point it's just coming down to artistry to make that sort of work.
Yeah, totally. The guys, where they could, stitched in extra elements of waterfalls or you know, riverbanks and stuff. And then at times, if they needed to, they just had to go all CG. But I think we researched it for a long time, and the effects team had a good solid year to develop everything that they needed. And you know, the end result, you sort of don't know where the CG starts and ends in a lot of shots, and it's quite convincing. To boost that realism from an animation perspective, we used motion capture, and for the green screen stuff, the actors on set, they had these barrel rigs that were sort of on these trolley wheels, and they could control the movement of the barrel themselves by just sort of walking along. And for a mid shot or a close up, you know, you never knew that they weren't floating on water.
and we got those barrel rigs and we adapted them and used them on the mocap stage and put markers on them and stuff. So when our mocap performers were pretending to, you know, ride barrels down rapids, we were not only capturing the dwarves, but we were capturing the barrel at the same time. And that was just invaluable for us as animators because we could get big impacts and motions and stuff, and the guys were holding on to the edge of the barrel. And all that remained, when we got that data into our animation scenes, we just had this, you know, rock-solid match between the barrel and the dwarf, and it meant we didn't have to do any, you know, extra manual work of sticking their hands onto the barrels or preventing intersections or anything, because it had all been captured in one take. And, you know, there's plenty of shots where there's CG dwarves kind of cruising down rapids and everything. So, yeah, it was really valuable.
I understand it was obviously a huge amount of work for Weta Digital, but I think we should also probably say that I think I'm right in saying there's about 98 hours of footage that got edited down to that stunning 7 minutes that are in the film. So I guess the other department that really sort of came up and contributed massively was the editorial. I mean, those guys really, really nailed it in terms of taking a lot of the elements and forming a very understandable narrative through what is obviously a fast-cutting action sequence.
Yeah, it turned out really, really well. And, you know, it's intercut with different areas of the sluice and everything. It's quite exciting and dynamic. Yeah, I guess it's just whittling it all down, isn't it, to the best parts. And it's interesting that you bring that up because years ago now, I was part of the previous team and we worked on that barrel sequence and we brainstormed dozens and dozens of gags. You know, what could happen when the dwarves are kind of trying to escape down a water course in barrels. And, you know, it was really exciting and fun sequence to work on. And it was just interesting to see which sort of gags survived into the final cut. And there's at least two or three that we came up with, you know, probably two or three years ago now that are in the final sequence. It's quite surreal to see those ideas kind of come through the pipeline from previs to the animation to motion capture and then through to water simulation and final rendering and everything. And, you know, the idea is sort of still there and still intact, and it's pretty satisfying.
I mean, there is drama in that sequence, obviously, but there is actually a lot of fun as well. I mean, it's a good emotional sort of fun ride.
Yeah.
And those gags play really well. I mean, the audience that I watched it with was cracking up.
Yeah, exactly. Same. And I saw it at a crew screening with all the people who'd already worked on it. But it's a real high point and everyone, you know, relaxes and enjoys that moment. And it's quite fun. And yeah, there's a lot of peril, but there's it's sort of the dwarves sort of come to their own, you know, they're resourceful. They can adapt to whatever is around them. And yeah, they also seem to be incredibly lucky.
they are very, very lucky. Though it was interesting, I was thinking that it's one of the big effect sequences that's in solid, harsh sunlight, like the spiders, the stuff that's going on at the end, obviously with Smaug, like a lot of the stuff that happens in forests and stuff is all dark and yeah, you can play on shadows. This is really just bright, bright sun.
Yep, there's nowhere to hide with your CG, that's for sure. And Jeff Capogreco, who supervised the sequence, did a great job with the digi doubles and you know, even the live action plate shots have extra trees and environment pieces added in, and it all works pretty seamlessly. Lots of water elements used to you know, make it feel energetic and dynamic, like water splashes on the lens and the camera sort of drops underwater at times and you've got foreground water sloshing around. So yeah, hats off to the guys who rendered it all and composited all that stuff, because it's you know, you spend years on the animation trying to make it convincing, but then, you know, you've got to hand it to the next team who, you know, need to make it look really real. And in this case, I think the guys did an amazing job.
I guess while we're highlighting that, the other team that you mentioned before that we probably should loop back on is whoever was in charge of the tracking. Because the object tracking and the camera tracking would have been fiercely difficult in some of those sequences, and yet that would have made your life a lot easier if you had solid bases upon which to put your characters into.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the guys match moving those barrels, it must have been a bit of a head scratcher from time to time, because like barrels would disappear under the water and then they'd pop up like sometimes seconds later. And sometimes multiple barrels would disappear under the water and then pop up. And
of course, it's shooting stereo, so you need it to be a really accurate track. You can't just sort of be faking it out.
Exactly. Like not only in sort of the 2D realm where it has to just visually look like it tracks, just it has to have the correct depth as well in stereo. So, you know, lots of checking has to be done there to make sure it's all going to sit in right in the final render.
Did I cut you off then? Were you about to say something?
I was just going to say that there was one shot where we discovered that a barrel kind of pops up out of the water about halfway through the shot. It's a really epic shot where you know the dwarves are under assault and they're doing all sorts of stuff to stay out of trouble. And about halfway through the shot, a live action barrel just sort of pops up out of the water. And it was like, where did that come from? It must have been underwater for ages. And it just highlighted how dangerous it would actually have been, you know, filming these live action barrels in this water course, you know, as the dam was unleashed and all the water came down. Man, it was just crazy. Like,
I like the fact that at that water course, the team ended up losing four barrels. They just had no idea where they went.
It's like, not really. And they would have been all dinged and bumped and, yeah.
Though I imagine a whole bunch of sort of hardy tourist, you know, souvenir hunters hunting around the river edge looking for, yeah, for Hobbit memorabilia.
A broken barrel with tracking markers on them.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it was a spectacular job. The importance of stereo in that, in terms of just sort of selling that stuff in. I mean, obviously the audience and I myself found it almost impossible, if not actually impossible, to pick where the digital water stopped and started. But the scene, to me, the secret of selling that in terms of a stereo and just the staging and the whole way it worked is placing your characters really in the scene, in the water, as opposed to anything else. And of course, in stereo, that's absolutely vital. It seems to me that getting them in there would really make a big difference.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, Peter often said to make a really dynamic shot, you can never have your dwarf and your barrel cut off at the bottom of frame, because it would just compose out badly and it would just look like they were kind of stuck on there. He always wanted to see, you know, a sort of a thin layer of water at the bottom of frame, so you could see where the water met the barrel and then, you know, the dwarf in the barrel. It was really important to him. And yeah, I think maybe that's what you found there about the integration and everything. It just sort of sat them in the water nicely, and it meant that the shots composed out well and you understood what was happening, and it just looked really cool.
So at a personal level, you said you started on the previs on that. When did you see the final shot for the first time? When was that?
The final shots not too long ago. We were really working on these water shots up until the last minute. They were one of the last reels to deliver.
I imagine they'd have delivered earlier, because I know they were started fairly early, of course. I imagine Smog had been the last thing to deliver.
The Forger sequence was one of the last to deliver, because it was one of the final shots to get final sequences to get worked out and turned over. But the sluice sequence was worked out a bit earlier on, but you know, we scheduled it so that it could be the last to deliver because of all the intense water simulations.
Right.
And we also scheduled our animation to be locked down well in advance of that, so that the water simulation team would have enough time to do their job right and you know, send things correctly with enough detail and resolution and stuff. So they were being rendered all down to the wire, basically. And you know, you can always render another layer to add to the realism. You can always, you know, tweaks and splashes and stuff. So because that sequence kind of lived or died by how realistic those water sims were, we really wanted to just nail that stuff. So we worked on it as long as we possibly could. So yeah, to answer your question about when I saw the final shots, on some of those shots it was probably a day or two before the deadline.
And this very point is one that I put to Joe Lettieri, that the barrel sequence for me really brought together what must have been every aspect of Weta Digital's set of skills, from rendering to tracking to water simulation to character animation to just full-on large-scale environment work.
It was, including, you know, a lot of live-action shooting to integrate everything together. I mean, the way we did that scene is we started blocking it off with previs, just, you know, coming up with ideas for gags. Peter had certain things that he wanted to try in the scene to really amp up the action. Even just starting with the idea that the dwarves, once they're going downriver, are being chased by the orcs, who are also being chased by the elves. And so we tried to stage, you know, action that would take advantage of each of those pieces. And we worked with Alan Lee and John Howe. They would start to do artwork of you know, different locations where the action might be happening. And we would build previs models to match those locations. And at the same time, Peter would take all these previs elements and he would be re-editing the sequence. And so it kind of came together organically to where we mapped out schematically what the whole flow of the action would be. Turned out to be about a 1 kilometer long, you know, section of river that we needed to cover all of the action. And so then we started to break it down. What could we shoot practically? So there were a couple of locations in New Zealand that we could use. There was a good location on the Polaris River that we could use to actually put the dwarves in barrels, because it was at the end of the sequence, the water was more slow moving. For the faster moving shots, we could go to the Arateatea Rapids, and there we would just throw in empty barrels that were weighted down, and then we would track our digital double dwarves, you know, into those. We also built a big sort of like a water course, a big circular course that we could shoot close-ups of the dwarves in the barrels, you know, floating in the river, and then just extend that, you know, the environment around it.
That was a bit like a theme park ride, wasn't it, really?
Exactly, very much like a theme park ride, yep. We had green screen elements of just the dwarves with, you know, barrels on wheels that they would just be able to mimic the performance. And then finally, we just had shots that were completely digital. So it did span the mix of, you know, take the guys in the water and maybe clean up the background a little bit, to this shot needs to be completely digital. The trees, the environments, the sky, the orcs, all the dwarves, the water simulations. It really ran the gamut for that whole sequence.
I think the water simulation is particularly impressive. I mean, it just was seamless. But I understand, like, on a sort of a water shot, you had something like 600 million particles. I mean, it's a huge amount of water sim work, and it's pretty computationally difficult. But I mean, integrating that in stereo so accurately is also complicated.
Yes, exactly. We spend a long time on those simulations. We would be able to look at the different live action pieces that we liked, use those as reference, and we would just work to match those and then integrate them with the fantastic landscape around it and just run the simulations over and over again. It got even more complex because we were using previs animation to block out the scene. So you might have a situation where you've got the dwarves in the barrels going by really fast because it's a nice bit of fast action, and then you put them in the water simulation and you realize they're traveling faster than the water. And so in order to make a believable simulation, now you have to go back and kind of slow their action down, but come up with a new camera move that still gives you the same sense of speed, and then re-simulate. So it was a constant, like, iterative cycle of looking at animation and looking at simulation and trying to make everything come together to get the story beats and the action beats that we needed.
And of course, this had water that needed to be placed into environments. So in fact, I think that's about 40 CG environments that built up that kilometer that you were talking about, because you had to keep on building around the water as well.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And it was all turned out to be very, you know, custom, because each bit of environment needed to be tailored for the action that we were shooting. And so we just made sections of the river piece by piece and just kept running new simulations on them.
If I could talk about some of the other environments for a second, I was just totally impressed by Lake Town in terms of the lighting and just how it had this sort of Dickens kind of London-esque feel. But the lighting of it, it just seemed to be one of the prettiest pieces of digital environment work I've seen in a while. Could you talk about that? Because it really is, it's very arty. It's artful.
Yeah, Lake Town, again, started off as a combination of, you know, working with Alan Lee to do some of the artwork, and then we worked with Dan Hanna and the art department to construct and build some of the live action pieces, because a lot of Lake Town was shot on a set. We made digital versions of all the buildings, and then we all, including the art department, worked to a larger plan of the city. So they built a couple of small sections of it for the stages, and then we filled it all in with the rest of the city. Plotted out a couple of the camera moves that we needed to get the big establishing shots, and then really just tried to get that feel of coming in, you know, in that early dawn light with the fog all around, and using that to help reveal the city with the low sun just coming up in that kind of cold air behind it. And so all of it was kind of to enhance that feeling of kind of the isolation, you know, of the city out in that lake. So you kind of got the feeling of the vulnerability that will obviously play into what happens later on in the story.
That Lake Town reveal and those high shots looking into the sort of to the backlight. I mean, I'm just wondering, is that a product of a really good physically plausible lighting sort of pipe that you have now, or is that like a lot of tricks and a lot of compositing work to get that looking so pretty?
Well, I mean, it's a little bit of both. It obviously has to be physically plausible to get something that's going to look realistic, but a lot of it really comes into how you dress those layers, because you still need the elements all in the right place to make it work. So the layout matters, right? I mean, we spent a long time just designing the layout of the building so that even though you couldn't see them, you could get a sense of the canals just because of how you saw the buildings were structured. You know, layering in different amounts of atmosphere that might be coming up from the canal beds, to help build up that depth. And so it was a lot of that just kind of constructing the look of it, and then also being able to light it in a physically plausible way.
Yeah, I think the other environment that's nice because it's not a ruin is the Elvian Kingdom, because mm-hmm. you've got structure here. It's kind of like this film's Rivendell in a sense, I guess, but it just really is a very proud, kind of strong environment that contrasts so well with what's going on around it in the outside of the film. Can you talk about that?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you're right. It was very much like Rivendell in that the architecture was meant to kind of enhance or grow out of the surroundings. But in this case, we were growing inward. So you enter this underground realm, and what you see is all the tree roots from the forest have grown down into the realm. And those are what the elves have used to kind of base the architecture on. So, you know, the walkways that go through it are these long, graceful tree branches, these tree roots. And a lot of the columns that are supporting, the architecture, the interior architecture, are growing out of these tree roots, or they're carved to mimic the tree roots. So you had the sort of natural growth and the architecture kind of joining together to give you this unified look of almost like a forest underground.
Yeah, I also liked how, unlike some other environments, we got to kind of see behind the scenes the kind of upstairs, downstairs nature of obviously where the cellar is and how that was servicing the upper, more formal areas. You had this real sense of a real community where there was a real substructure of people that had to kind of service the Elvian kingdom of the more formal environment above.
Mm-hmm, exactly. I mean, that was part of the story, you know, having the cellars and the dungeons, but also the wine cellar, and we wanted to be able to tie that into the grandeur of the throne and the grandeur, of the king. And so you did get a sense that this is a vast underground kingdom, and there is a very live community there.
Well, look, I know New Zealand gives you a beautiful platform upon which to start your work, but certainly mm-hmm. these environments that the team have built out have given such depth to the story. Yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Oh, fantastic. That's really nice to hear.
Thank you so much for taking time to talk to us. We do appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Mike. Good to talk to you.
Thanks so much. Bye.
Okay. Bye now.
Well, thanks for that, guys, and a big thanks to the folks from Weta Digital, because it's the holiday season. These guys have just wrapped a long period of work on the film. Talking to them from various locations is really great that they made the time to share with us their experiences on the film. So big thanks to that. And of course, a big thanks to you here at the end of the year to you, our listeners and readers of Effects Guide. We really enjoy doing this for all of you. We really appreciate the special support for those of you who are FX Insider members. And we truly hope you had a great year, and really best wishes for a great and healthy 2014 as well. So for my partners, Mike Seymour and Jeff Huser, thanks for taking the time to listen, and we'll talk to you next year. Bye.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.